Conclusion. Experts and democracy. A people who mean to be their own governors must arm themselves with the power which knowledge gives. James Madison. I reserve the right to be ignorant. That's the Western way of life. From The Spy Who Came In from the Cold. The experts are terrible. During the 2016 Brexit debate over whether the United Kingdom should leave the European Union, advocates of leaving the EU specifically identified experts, most of whom were warning that Brexit was a terrible idea, as enemies of the ordinary voter. A leader in the Brexit movement, Michael Gove, argued that facts were not as important as the feelings of the British voter. "I think people in this country," he sniffed, "have had enough of experts." But as an American writer and foreign policy expert, Michael Traub, later noted about Gove's sniping, "The word expert is, of course, the pejorative term for someone who knows what he or she is talking about. Like Gove, I imagine, who graduated from Oxford and spent years as a minister in Conservative Party governments. What Gove was actually saying was that people should be free to build gratifying fantasies free from unpleasant facts." Nigel Farage, the leader of the nativist United Kingdom Independence Party, even suggested that the experts were actually on the take, working for the British government or in the pay of the European Union itself. In July 2016, the Leave vote won with just under 52% of the vote in a national referendum. The attack on the experts was part of a strategy meant to capitalize on the political illiteracy of a fair number of British voters and their instinctive mistrust of the intellectual elites who overwhelmingly opposed Brexit. Within days, but with the votes safely counted, the Brexiteers admitted that many of their claims had been either exaggerated or even wrong. Frankly, the British politician and Brexit advocate, Daniel Hannan, said on British television, "If people watching think that they have voted and there is now going to be zero immigration from the EU, they are going to be disappointed." Hannan's comments provoked a backlash from voters who, apparently, thought that such a policy was exactly what they had chosen. "There really is no pleasing some people," Hannan said, and he then announced that he would take a month off Twitter. Britain's actual exit from the EU is still years in the future. Anti-intellectualism and the consequent distrust of expertise, however, played a more immediate and central role in the United States during the 2016 presidential campaign. At a Wisconsin rally in early 2016, Republican candidate Donald Trump unleashed an attack on experts. In earlier debates, Trump had often been caught at a loss for words over basic issues of public policy, and now he was striking back. "They say, 'Oh, Trump doesn't have experts,'" he told the crowd. "You know, I've always wanted to say this. The experts are terrible. They say, 'Donald Trump needs a foreign policy advisor.' But supposing I didn't have one, would it be worse than what we're doing now?" Trump's sneering at experts tapped into a long-standing American belief that experts and intellectuals are not only running the lives of ordinary people, but also doing a lousy job of it. Trump's rise in 2016 was the result of many factors. Some of them, like a crowded field that produced only a plurality winner, purely matters of circumstance. Trump's eventual victory, however, was also undeniably one of the most recent and one of the loudest trumpets sounding the impending death of expertise. Consider the various ways in which Trump's campaign represented a one-man campaign against established knowledge. He was one of the original birthers who demanded that Barack Obama prove his American citizenship. He quoted the National Enquirer approvingly as a source of news. He sided with anti-vaccine activism. He admitted that he gets most of his information on foreign policy from the shows on Sunday morning television. He suggested that Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia, who died from natural causes in early 2016, might have been murdered. And he charged that the father of one of his opponents, Ted Cruz, was involved in the mother of all conspiracy theories, the assassination of John F. Kennedy. Outright mistakes in stump speeches are an occupational hazard for political candidates, as when then-Senator Barack Obama claimed to have visited all 57 states. But Trump's ignorance during the campaign was willful and persistent. He He had no idea how to answer even rudimentary questions about policy. Rather than be shamed by his lack of knowledge, he exulted in it. Asked about the nuclear triad, the massive arsenal that would be at his disposal as President of the United States, Trump said, "We have to be extremely vigilant and extremely careful when it comes to nuclear. Nuclear changes the whole ball game." Pressed about what he meant, he added, I think for me, nuclear is just the power. The devastation is very important to me." These were not missteps. Asked to clarify Trump's comments later, one of Trump's spokespeople waved away the entire matter as irrelevant. Trump, Katrina Pearson told Fox News, was tough, and that's all that mattered. "What good does it do to have a good nuclear triad if you're afraid to use it?" she asked. Pearson's fellow guest was the attorney and political commentator Kurt Schlichter, a retired Army colonel whose military specializations included chemical and nuclear issues, and who by any standard is an ultra-conservative. Schlichter was visibly astonished. "The point of the nuclear triad is to be afraid to use the damn thing," he said emphatically. Trump survived all of this, seized the Republican nomination, and won because in the end, he connected with a particular kind of voter who believes that knowing about things like America's nuclear deterrent is just so much pointy-headed claptrap. Worse, voters not only didn't care that Trump is ignorant or wrong, they likely were unable to recognize his ignorance or errors. The psychologist David Dunning, who along with his colleague Justin Kruger discovered the Dunning-Kruger effect, in which uninformed or incompetent people are unlikely to recognize their own lack of knowledge or incompetence, believes that the dynamic they describe was at work among the electorate and perhaps even central to understanding the bizarre nature of the 2016 election. Dunning wrote, "Many commentators have pointed to Trump's confident missteps as products of Trump's alleged narcissism and egotism. My take would be that it's the other way around. Not seeing the mistakes for what they are allows any potential narcissism and egotism to expand unchecked. In voters, lack of expertise would be lamentable, but perhaps not so worrisome, if people had some sense of how imperfect their civic knowledge is. If they did, they could repair it. But the Dunning-Kruger effect suggests something different. It suggests that some voters, especially those facing significant distress in their life, might like some of what they hear from Trump, but they don't know enough to hold him accountable for the serious gaffes he makes." In other words, it's not that Trump supporters were excusing him when he blurted out his most ignorant claims, but rather, as Dunning says, they failed to recognize those gaffes as missteps. Trump's strongest support in 2016, unsurprisingly, was concentrated among people with low levels of education. "I love the poorly educated," Trump exulted after winning the Nevada caucuses, and that love was clearly reciprocated. In Trump, Americans who believe shadowy forces are ruining their lives and that any visible intellectual ability is itself a suspicious characteristic in a national leader found a champion. But where would people get such ideas, such as believing that the political elite and their intellectual allies are conspiring against them? In part, they get these ideas by observing the behavior of the political elite and their intellectual allies. A month after Trump decried the uselessness of experts, for example, one of President Obama's top foreign policy advisors validated exactly the kind of suspicions that fuel attacks on expert participation in national policy. Describing the Obama administration's press for Congress and the American public to accept a deal with Iran on its nuclear weapons program, Deputy National Security Advisor Ben Rhodes told the New York Times Magazine that the administration knew it would have to discourse the blank out of this. Rhodes gave the interview to a Times reporter, David Samuels, whose own objectivity on the Iran deal as well as about some of the people named in the piece was called into question when the story appeared. Still, the Rhodes admissions were remarkably blunt. He proudly identified think tanks, experts, and journalists who he claimed were part of the administration's press for the deal. "We created an echo chamber," he admitted, when I asked him to explain the onslaught of freshly minted experts cheerleading for the deal. "They were saying things that validated what we had given them to say. When I asked whether the prospect of this same kind of far-reaching spin campaign being run by a different administration is something that scares him, he admitted that it does. I mean, I'd prefer a sober, reasoned public debate, after which members of Congress reflect and take a vote, he said, shrugging. But that's impossible. It is not unusual for senior government officials to assert that some matters, especially in national security, are too important and complicated to be left to uninformed public debate. Secret diplomacy and campaigns to win public opinion are part and parcel of the history of every democratic government, including the United States. What Rhodes said, however, was different and far more damaging to the relationship between experts and public policy. In effect, he bragged that the deal with Iran was sold by warping the debate among the experts themselves, and by taking advantage of the fact that the new media, and especially the younger journalists now taking over national reporting, wouldn't know any better. The average reporter we talk to is 27 years old, and their only reporting experience consists of being around political campaigns, Rhodes said. That's a sea change. They literally know nothing. Rhodes's implication was clear. Not only did he think the public was too stupid to understand the deal, which was not wrong, although Rhodes did nothing to make them any smarter, but that everyone else, including Congress, was too stupid to get it as well. For Rhodes, contaminating the debate with misinformation was just a requirement for the greater good. Trump and Rhodes, in different ways, used the public's ignorance to serve their own interests. They differed only in tactics. Trump sought power during the 2016 election by mobilizing the angriest and most ignorant among the electorate, while Rhodes staged-managed the Iran deal by throwing a fictional narrative out for public consumption and bypassing the electorate entirely while he and others did as they thought best, in secret. Both of these situations are intolerable. There is plenty of blame to go around for the parlous state of the role of expertise in American life, and this book has apportioned much of it. Experts themselves, as well as educators, journalists, corporate entertainment media, and others, have all played their part. In the end, however, there is only one group of people who must bear the ultimate responsibility for this current state of affairs, and only they can change any of it: the citizens of the United States of America. Expertise and democracy. The death spiral. Expertise and government rely upon each other, especially in a democracy. The technological and economic progress that ensures the well-being of a population requires the division of labor, which in turn leads to the creation of professions. Professionalism encourages experts to do their best in serving their clients, to respect their own boundaries, and to demand their boundaries be respected by others as part of an overall service to the ultimate client, society itself. Dictatorships, too, demand this same service of experts, but they extract it by threat and direct its use by command. This is why dictatorships are less efficient and less productive than democracies, despite the historical myths many Americans continue to believe about the putative efficiency of Nazi Germany and other such regimes. In a democracy, the expert's service to the public is part of the social contract. Citizens delegate the power of decision on myriad issues to elected representatives and their expert advisors, while experts, for their part, ask that their efforts be received in good faith by a public that has informed itself enough to make reasoned judgments. The relationship between experts and citizens, like almost all relationships in a democracy, is built on trust. When that trust collapses, experts and laypeople become warring factions. And when that happens, democracy itself can enter a death spiral that presents an immediate danger of decay, either into rule by the mob or toward elitist technocracy. Both are authoritarian outcomes, and both threaten the United States today. This is why the collapse of the relationship between experts and citizens is a dysfunction of democracy itself. The abysmal literacy, both political and general, of the American public is the foundation for all of these problems. It is the soil in which all of the other dysfunctions have taken root and prospered, with the 2016 election only its most recent expression. As the writer Daniel Libet described it, the nation's public policy experts found the 2016 presidential race an increasingly demoralizing lesson in the imperviousness of the American voter. The warning signs, however, were present long before then. As the writer Susan Jacoby put it in 2008, the most disturbing aspect of the American march toward ignorance is not lack of knowledge per se, but arrogance about that lack of knowledge. She wrote, "The problem is not just the things we do not know. Consider the 1 in 5 American adults who, according to the National Science Foundation, thinks the sun revolves around the earth. It's the alarming number of Americans who have smugly concluded that they do not need to know such things in the first place. The toxic brew of anti-rationalism and ignorance hurts discussions of U.S. public policy on topics from healthcare to taxation." Ordinary Americans might never have liked the educated or professional classes very much, but until recently they did not widely disdain their actual learning as a bad thing in itself. It might even be too kind to call this merely anti-rational. It is almost reverse evolution, away from tested knowledge and backward toward folk wisdom and myths passed by word of mouth, except with all of it now sent along at the speed of electrons. This plummeting literacy and growth of willful ignorance is part of a vicious circle of disengagement between citizens and public policy. People know little and care less about how they are governed, or how their economic, scientific, or political structures actually function. Yet, as all of these processes thus become more incomprehensible, citizens feel more alienated. Overwhelmed, they turn away from education and civic involvement and withdraw into other pursuits. This, in turn, makes them less capable citizens, and the cycle continues and strengthens, especially when the public appetite for escape is easily fed by any number of leisure industries. Awash in gadgets and conveniences that were once unimaginable even within their own lifetimes, Americans, and many other Westerners, if we are to be fair about it, have become almost childlike in their refusal to learn enough to govern themselves or to guide the policies that affect their lives. This is a collapse of functional citizenship, and it enables a cascade of other baleful consequences. In the absence of informed citizens, for example, more knowledgeable administrative and intellectual elites do in fact take over the daily direction of the state and society. In a passage often cited by Western conservatives, and especially loved by American libertarians, the Austrian economist F. A. Hayek wrote in 1960, "The greatest danger to liberty today comes from the men who are most needed and most powerful in modern government, namely, the efficient expert administrators exclusively concerned with what they regard as the public good." Even the most intellectually minded thinkers across the American spectrum would agree with Hayek. Unelected bureaucrats and policy specialists in many spheres exert tremendous influence on the daily lives of Americans. Today, however, this situation is by default rather than by design. Populism actually reinforces this elitism because the celebration of ignorance cannot launch communications satellites, negotiate the rights of U.S. citizens overseas, or provide for effective medications, all of which are daunting tasks even the dimmest citizens now demand and take for granted. Faced with a public that has no idea how most things work, experts likewise disengage, choosing to speak mostly to each other rather than to lay people. Meanwhile, Americans have increasingly unrealistic expectations of what their political and economic system can provide. This sense of entitlement is one reason they are continually angry at experts, and especially at elitists, a word that in modern American usage can mean almost anyone with any education, who refuses to coddle the public's mistaken beliefs. When told that ending poverty or preventing terrorism is a lot harder than it looks, Americans roll their eyes. Unable to comprehend all of the complexity around them, they choose instead to comprehend almost none of it, and then sullenly blame experts, politicians, and bureaucrats for seizing control of their lives. The knowers and the deciders. This underscores another problem motivating the death spiral in which democracy and expertise are caught. Citizens do not understand, or do not choose to understand, the difference between experts and elected policymakers. For many Americans, all elites are now just an undifferentiated mass of educated, rich, and powerful people. This is patent silliness. Not all rich people are powerful, and not all powerful people are rich. Intellectuals and policy experts are seldom rich or powerful. Trust me on that one. Whatever else George W. Bush may have gotten wrong during his presidency, he was right when he reminded Americans that when it came to the actions of his administration, he was the decider. Experts can only propose. Elected leaders dispose. In fact, policymaking experts and elected leaders are almost never the same group, and it cannot be otherwise. There are simply not enough hours in the day for a legislator, even in a city council or a small U.S. state, and much less for a president, to master all of the issues modern policymaking requires. This is why policymakers engage experts, the knowers, to advise them. Sometimes this partnership between advisors and policymakers fails. Experts get things wrong, and they counsel political leaders to take courses of action that can result in disaster. Critics of the role of expertise point to national traumas, like the Vietnam War as one such example. With the benefit of hindsight, these criticisms are often made as though such painful choices could have been avoided by consulting the wisdom of the common citizen. This call to fall back on the knowledge and virtue of laypeople, however, is romanticized nonsense. Evan Thomas, a journalist and biographer of Richard Nixon, admitted that the best and the brightest, among them academics like Henry Kissinger, and corporate titans like Secretary of Defense Robert S. McNamara, were far from perfect, and that they bear the blame for Vietnam and the 58,000 American soldiers who died there, not to mention the millions of Vietnamese. But, as Thomas points out, those same experts and elites strengthened a world order balanced precariously on the edge of nuclear war. They expanded trade, deepened alliances, and underwrote billions in foreign aid. None of these policies would have been popular in and of themselves, but they helped the United States and the West to survive the Cold War and to reach its peaceful end. More important, what kinds of policies would non-experts or populists have chosen? Thomas challenged readers to contrast the mistakes of the 1960s to times when Washington allowed foreign policy to be set by public consensus. He wrote, "In the 1930s, Congress closed off free trade to protect American industry and listened to voters who wanted a smaller, less costly military with no entangling alliances. The results? The Smoot-Hawley Tariff contributed to the Great Depression, and the failure of the League of Nations allowed the rise of fascism and global war." This illustrates an important point. Then, as now, Americans tend to think about issues like macroeconomic policy or foreign affairs only when things go wrong. The rest of the time, they remain happily unaware of the policies and processes that function well every day while the nation goes about its business. The question nonetheless remains whether America really needs all these experts, especially when their advice becomes so spread out over so many people that no one seems responsible when disaster strikes. Andrew Bacevich, for one, has called for vanquishing the modern expert class, at least in public policy. Writing, "Policy intellectuals, eggheads presuming to instruct the mere mortals who actually run for office, are a blight on the republic. Like some invasive species, they infest present-day Washington, where their presence strangles common sense and has brought to the verge of extinction the simple ability to perceive reality. A benign appearance, well-dressed types testifying before Congress, pontificating in print and on TV, or even filling key positions in the executive branch, belies a malign impact. They are like Asian carp let loose in the Great Lakes. The irony here is that Bacevich himself is a prolific author, a former senior military officer, and a retired professor, who regularly proposes very specific instructions for the same group of mortals. Still, he has a point. In addition to the 500 or 600 visible policymakers at the top levels of the U.S. government, there are thousands of experts behind them who may, in fact, not be very good at what they do. Experts cannot dodge their own responsibilities here. The knowers cannot merely hide behind elected officials every time something goes wrong, telling the public to leave them alone and instead go and punish the deciders. When the experts screw up, the leaders who trusted their advice on behalf of the public need to adjudicate their failures and to decide what kind of correction is needed. Sometimes, the remedy for expert failure is the time-honored Blue Ribbon Panel and its recommendations. Sometimes the answer is just to fire somebody. In his seminal work on expertise, however, Philip Tetlock suggests other ways in which experts might be held more accountable without merely trashing the entire relationship between experts and the public. There are many possibilities, including more transparency and competition, in which experts in any field have to maintain a record of their work, come clean about how often they were right or wrong, and actually have journals, universities, and other gatekeepers hold their peers responsible more often for mistakes. Whether this would work is another matter, and Tetlock acknowledges the many barriers to such solutions. The most daunting barrier, however, is the public's own laziness. None of these efforts to track and grade experts will matter very much if ordinary citizens do not care enough to develop even a basic interest in such matters. Tetlock points out that laypeople, unfortunately, are not usually interested in finding experts with excellent track records. They are mostly interested in experts who are accessible without much effort and who already agree with their views. As Tetlock rightly notes, it is not enough to encourage accountability among the providers of intellectual products if the consumers are unmotivated to be discriminating judges of competing claims and counterclaims. These consumers may well be less interested in the dispassionate pursuit of truth than they are in buttressing their prejudices, and when this happens, laypeople approach the role of expertise with the psychology of the sports arena, not the seminar room. Experts need to own their advice and to hold each other accountable. For any number of reasons, the glut of academic degrees, the lack of interest on the part of the public, the inability to keep up with the production of knowledge in the information age, they have not lived up to this duty as conscientiously as their privileged position in society requires. They can do better, even if those efforts might, in the main, go unnoticed. There are measures that experts can take to improve their accountability. There are other issues in the relationship with the public, however, that are beyond their control. Laypeople need to think about the ways in which they misunderstand the role of expert advice in a democratic republic. Among the many misconceptions the public has about experts and policymakers, 5 are especially worth considering. First, experts are not puppeteers. They cannot control when leaders take their advice. Even in the closest relationships between an elected politician and an expert advisor, there is not a complete fusing of beliefs. Whether Nixon and Kissinger or Obama and Rhodes, no leader is merely the vessel by which experts implement ideas. Any expert worth his or her salt has stories of defeat in the policy game. I was, many years ago, an aide to a senior U.S. senator who treated me as a trusted advisor, but who also once threw me out of his office in a fusillade of curses during a principal disagreement in the tense days leading up to the 1991 Gulf War. While there is usually a close identity of interests and views between a political leader and the expert staff, the policymaker or elected official has pressures and responsibilities the expert will never feel, and conflict is inevitable. Second, experts cannot control how leaders implement their advice. There is a kind of monkey's paw problem here for experts. The monkey's paw, listeners might recall, is a famous early 20th century story about a magic talisman that granted wishes in the worst way. When the main character in the tale wishes for money, it comes in the form of compensation for the death of his son. Experts can advise policymakers on what to do, but they may find their advice taken in ways that were never intended. An economist who is also an environmentalist might believe that lowering taxes is a good idea, for example, only to find later that her advice was indeed taken by a Congress wanting to lower taxes on gasoline. Third, no single expert guides a policy from conception through execution, a reality that the public often finds bewildering and frustrating. This is why policy analysis is an entirely scholarly discipline in itself, especially in the study of large organizations like governments and businesses. The knowers and the deciders may have settled on what they want, but the institutions below them, like players in a huge game of telephone, can mangle intended policies and turn them into something else, with perverse effects by the time the whole project comes to fruition. Fourth, experts cannot control how much of their advice leaders will take. Experts can offer advice, but often political leaders will often hear only the parts they want to hear, specifically the parts that will be popular with their respective constituents. They will then mobilize experts that emphasize the message they prefer. Some experts might, for example, advocate cutting taxes. Others might call for increased spending on pet projects ranging from the social safety net to national defense. Both positions, cutting taxes and increasing spending, may have a logical foundation, but they cannot usually be adopted at the same time. The experts, however, cannot control the fact that politicians might well choose all of the options anyway, even if they conflict with each other. The next set of experts called in will then be asked to help solve the mystery of a massive budget deficit. The public, unfortunately, is much the same way. When nutritional scientists took eggs off the list of dietary culprits, they didn't intend for people to order fast food egg sandwiches every morning as part of a healthy breakfast. People hear what they want to hear and then stop listening. And when their incomplete adoption of an expert's advice produces poor results, they blame the experts for being incompetent, because everybody has to blame somebody. Finally, experts can only offer alternatives. They cannot, however, make choices about values. They can describe problems, but they cannot tell people what they should want to do about those problems, even when there is wide agreement on the nature of those challenges. Is the Earth's climate changing? Most experts believe it is, and they believe they know why. Whether their models, extrapolated out for decades and centuries, are accurate is a legitimate area for debate. What experts cannot answer is what to do about climate change. It might well be that Boston, or Shanghai, or London will be underwater in 50 years, but it might well also be that voters, who have the right to be wrong, will choose to shift that problem to later generations, rather than to risk jobs or comfort now. Experts can tell the voters what is likely to happen, but voters must engage those issues and decide what they value most, and therefore, what they want done. Letting Boston slide into the harbor is not my preferred outcome, but it is not a failure of expertise if people ignore the experts and let it happen anyway. It is instead a failure of civic engagement. If Boston is to become Venice, it should be by choice, not by accident. When voters remain utterly unwilling to understand important issues because they are too difficult or discomforting, it is unsurprising that experts will give up talking to them and instead rely on their positions in the policy world to advocate for their own solutions. Experts sometimes give poor advice or make mistakes, but an advanced society and its government cannot do without them, no matter what an increasing number of Americans seem to believe. To ignore expert advice is simply not a realistic option, not only due to the complexity of policymaking, but because to do so is to absolve citizens of their responsibilities to learn about issues that matter directly to their own well-being. Moreover, when the public no longer makes a distinction between experts and policymakers and merely wants to blame everyone in the policy world for outcomes that distress them, the eventual result will not be better policy, but more politicization of expertise. Politicians will never stop relying on experts. They will, however, move to rely on experts who will tell them, and the angry laypeople banging on their office doors, whatever it is they want to hear. This is the worst of all worlds, in which both democracy and expertise are corrupted because neither democratic leaders nor their expert advisors want to tangle with an ignorant electorate. At that point, expertise no longer serves the public interest, but the interest of whatever political clique is taking the temperature of the public at any given moment. We are already perilously close to this outcome in modern America. A republic, if you know what one is. The challenges of expert accountability are compounded by the fact that most Americans don't seem to understand their own system of government. The United States is a republic, not a democracy. One hardly ever hears the word republic anymore, which reveals in a small way the degree to which modern Americans confuse democracy as a general political philosophy with a republic as its expression in a form of government. In 1787, Benjamin Franklin was supposedly asked what would emerge from the Constitutional Convention being held in Philadelphia. "A republic," Franklin answered, "if you can keep it." Today, the bigger challenge is to find anyone who knows what a republic actually is. This is crucial because lay people too easily forget that the republican form of government under which they live was not designed for mass decisions about complicated issues. Neither, of course, was it designed for rule by a tiny group of technocrats or experts. Rather, it was meant to be the vehicle by which an informed electorate, informed being the key word here, could choose other people to represent them and to make decisions on their behalf. Classical American thought might be rooted in the glory that was Athens, but the United States is not, nor was it ever meant to be, anything like the Athenian marketplace. And for that, Americans should be grateful. As the writer Malcolm Gladwell pointed out in 2010, large organizations do not make decisions by polling everyone in them, no matter how democratic it might seem. He writes, "Car companies sensibly use a network to organize their hundreds of suppliers, but not to design their cars. No one believes that the articulation of a coherent design philosophy is best handled by a sprawling, leaderless organizational system. Because networks don't have a centralized leadership structure and clear lines of authority, they have real difficulty reaching consensus and setting goals. They can't think strategically. They are chronically prone to conflict and error. How do you make difficult decisions about tactics or strategy or philosophical direction when everyone has an equal say?" This is one of many challenges Republican government was designed to overcome. Even when most people know what they're doing in their own area of competence, they cannot agglomerate their decisions into coherent public policy the same way as if they are guessing the weight of a bull or trying to pin down the target price of a stock. The Republican solution allows a smaller group of people to aggregate the public's often irresolvable demands. Determining what the public actually wants, however, is exponentially more difficult when the electorate is not competent in any of the matters at hand. Lay people complain about the rule of experts and they demand greater involvement in complicated national questions, but many of them only express their anger and make these demands after abdicating their own important role in the process, namely, to stay informed and politically literate enough to choose representatives who can act on their behalf. In the words of Ilya Somin, "When we elect government officials based on ignorance, they rule over not only those who voted for them, but all of society. When we exercise power over other people, we have a moral obligation to do so in at least a reasonably informed way." This is not the place for a meditation on the American form of representative democracy, especially since there are already plenty of copies of the Federalist Papers still available. But the death of expertise and its associated attacks on knowledge fundamentally undermine the Republican system of government. Worse, These attacks are campaigns conducted by those least capable of supplanting that system. The most poorly informed people among us are those who seem to be the most dismissive of experts and are demanding the greatest say in matters about which they have exerted almost no effort to educate themselves. Consider the fact that people change what they say they want based on who they think is advocating a position. The comedian Jimmy Kimmel was once again the prankster here. He stopped people on the street and asked them which of the tax plans offered by Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump they preferred. The interviewees, however, did not know that Kimmel had switched the details of each plan. As the Hill newspaper later reported, the answers depended on whom people thought they were supporting. The article stated, "Sure enough, one by one, the Clinton voters were stunned to discover that they were vouching for the proposal of her arch-rival. One man, when told he was supporting Trump's plan rather than Clinton's, decided to go for broke. 'Well, I support Donald Trump then.'" As it turns out, Kimmel's hijinks actually illustrated a truth long known to pollsters and campaign experts. Voters are often more interested in candidates and their personalities than in their ideas or policies. The Huffington Post's polling director, Ariel Edwards Levy, put it this way: "Americans, regardless of their political views, don't have a solid opinion about every single issue of the day, particularly when it concerns a complicated or obscure topic. People tend, reasonably, to rely on partisan cues. If a politician they support is in favor of a bill, they're likely to think it's a good idea, or vice versa." When Levy and her colleagues conducted a more formal version of the Kimmel ambush, they found the same thing. Republicans who strongly disagree with Democratic Party positions on health care, Iran, and affirmative action objected far less if they thought the same policies were those of Donald Trump. Democrats, for their part, went in the other direction. They were less supportive of their own party's policies if they thought they were Trump's positions. At least tax policy and health care are real issues with real positions attached to them. In 2015, Public Policy Polling, a liberal polling group, asked both Republicans and Democrats whether they would support bombing the country of Agrabah. Nearly a third of Republican respondents said they would support such action. Only 13% were opposed, and the rest were unsure. Democrats were less inclined to military action. Only 19% of self-identified Democrats supported bombing, while 36% decisively voiced their opposition. Agrabah doesn't exist. It's a fictional country in the 1992 animated Disney film Aladdin. Liberals crowed that this poll was evidence of the ignorance and aggressiveness of Republicans, while conservatives countered that it only showed how Democrats were reflexively against military action, no matter how little they knew about the situation. For experts, however, there was no way around the overall reality captured in the poll, even if only accidentally. 43% of Republicans and 55% of Democrats had an actual, defined view on bombing a place in a cartoon. Some of these games are unfair to the public. Ordinary people are busy living their lives, not trying to figure out if they're being manipulated by pollsters or pranked by comedians like Kimmel, or the Fox News personality Jesse Waters, who conducts similar pop quizzes on the street. This is especially true when voters are presented with all sides of the issues in the media without any indication of which views are more authoritative than another. As the psychologist Derek Kohler put it, "Government action is guided in part by public opinion. Public opinion is guided in part by perceptions of what experts think. But public opinion may, and often does, deviate from expert opinion, not simply, it seems, because the public refuses to acknowledge the legitimacy of experts, but also because the public may not be able to tell where the majority of expert opinion lies. A talk show, for example, with one scientist who says genetically modified organisms, GMOs, are safe, and one activist who says they are dangerous, looks balanced. But in reality, that is ridiculously skewed because nearly 9 out of 10 scientists think GMOs are safe for consumption. At some point, in the midst of all the bickering, the public simply gives up and goes back to relying on simpler sources of information, even if it's a meme on Facebook. This is no excuse, however, for citizen ignorance and disengagement, and especially for hyper-partisan attachments that make people change their minds about policy only because of who advocated them. If the public has no idea about the substance of an issue and will vote based on who they like rather than what they want, it's difficult to put too much blame on policymakers and their expert advisors for being confused themselves. How can a republic function if the people who sent their representatives to decide questions of war and peace cannot tell the difference between Agrabah, Ukraine, or Syria? Put another way, when the public claims it has been misled or kept in the dark, experts and policymakers cannot help but ask, how would you know? When laypeople disregard expertise and declare themselves fed up with everything and everyone, they forget that the people they elected still have to make decisions, every day, about an ongoing blizzard of issues. These officials do not have the luxury of casting a pox upon the experts and the polls and then retreating to their televisions and computer screens and game controllers. They have to make commitments, sometimes of lives and always of money, on everything from navigation rights to childcare. These decisions and how they are implemented will affect the lives of all citizens, the informed as well as the ignorant, the involved and the detached. The breakdown of trust between the public, experts, and elected officials in a republic goes in all directions. The public, especially, needs to be able to trust leaders and their expert advisors. This relationship becomes impossible to sustain, however, when laypeople have no idea what they're talking about or what they want. When that trust breaks down, public ignorance can be turned by cynical manipulation into a political weapon. Anti-intellectualism is itself a means of short-circuiting democracy, because a stable democracy in any culture relies on the public actually understanding the implications of its own choices. Most laypeople, already suspicious of the educated classes, need little prodding to rebel against experts, even when such rebellions are cynically led by other intellectuals. In 1942, President Franklin D. Roosevelt asked radio listeners to go and purchase maps so they could follow along as he narrated the progress of World War II. Maps quickly sold out across the country. In 2006, fewer than 65 years later, a national study found that nearly half of Americans between the ages of 18 and 24, that is, those most likely to have to fight in a war, did not think it was necessary to know the location of other countries in which important news was being made. A decade later, during the 2016 election, Donald Trump raised cheers when he summed up his approach to terrorists in the Middle East. I would bomb the shit out of them. I'd blow up the pipes. I'd blow up the refineries. I'd blow up every single inch. There would be nothing left. A republic, if you can keep it, or if you can find it on a map. I'm as good as you. Finally, and most disturbingly, citizens of the Western democracies, and Americans in particular, no longer understand the concept of democracy itself. This, perhaps more than anything, has corroded the relationship between experts and citizens. The relationship between experts and citizens is not democratic. All people are not, and can never be, equally talented or intelligent. Democratic societies, however, are always tempted to this resentful insistence on equality, which becomes oppressive ignorance if given its head. And this, sadly, is the state of modern America. Citizens no longer understand democracy to mean a condition of political equality, in which one person gets one vote, and every individual is no more and no less equal in the eyes of the law. Rather, Americans now think of democracy as a state of actual equality, in which every opinion is as good as any other, on almost any subject under the sun. Feelings are more important than facts. If people think vaccines are harmful, or if they believe that half of the U.S. budget is going to foreign aid, then it is undemocratic and elitist to contradict them. This problem is not new, nor is it unique to the United States. The British writer C.S. Lewis warned long ago of the danger to democracy, when people no longer recognize any difference between political equality and actual equality, in a vivid 1959 essay featuring one of his most famous literary creations, a brilliant and evil demon named Screwtape. As one of the Inferno's most senior bureaucrats, Screwtape is invited to give the commencement address at Hell's Training College for New Tempters. During his speech, Screwtape leaves aside what, for him, is the dull business of individual temptation, and instead surveys the global landscape. While he is repulsed by human progress, including the French and American revolutions, and the abolition of slavery, among other moments, he sees great hope, for hell, not for human beings, in capturing the concept of democracy and wresting it away from its noble meaning. "Democracy is the word with which you must lead them by the nose," Screwtape gleefully advises the graduates, and he then promises that by use of the word, purely as an incantation, human beings can be fooled not only into believing an obvious lie, but led to nurture that lie as a cherished feeling. "The feeling, I mean, is of course that which prompts a man to say, 'I'm as good as you.' No man who says, 'I'm as good as you,' believes it. He would not say it if he did. The Saint Bernard never says it to the toy dog, nor the scholar to the dunce, nor the employable to the bum, nor the pretty woman to the plain. The claim to equality outside the strictly political field is made only by those who feel themselves to be in some way inferior. What it expresses is precisely the itching, smarting, writhing awareness of an inferiority which a human being refuses to accept, and therefore resents, yes, and therefore resents every kind of superiority in others, denigrates it, wishes its annihilation." This was the same warning José Ortega y Gasset gave when he wrote Revolt of the Masses in 1930, writing, "The mass crushes beneath it everything that is different, everything that is excellent, individual, qualified, and select. Anybody who is not like everybody, who does not think like everybody, runs the risk of being eliminated." "I'm as good as you," Screwtape chortles at the end of his address, "is a useful means for the destruction of democratic societies." And so it is. When resentful laypeople demand that all marks of achievement, including expertise, be leveled and equalized in the name of democracy and fairness, there is no hope for either democracy or fairness. Everything becomes a matter of opinion, with all views dragged to the lowest common denominator in the name of equality. An outbreak of whooping cough because an ignoramus would not vaccinate a child is a sign of tolerance. The collapse of a foreign alliance because a provincial isolationist can't find other nations on an atlas is a triumph of egalitarianism. Democracy, as practiced in the United States in the early 21st century, has become a resentful, angry business. The fragile egos of narcissistic college students jostle against the outraged, wounded self-identity of talk radio addicts, all of whom demand to be taken with equal seriousness by everyone else, regardless of how extreme or uninformed their views are. Experts are derided as elitists, one of many groups putatively oppressing we the people, a term now used by voters indiscriminately and mostly to mean me. Expert advice or any kind of informed deliberation by anyone whom lay people perceive as an elite, which is to say almost everyone but themselves, is rejected as a matter of first principles. No democracy can go on this way. The Revolt of the Experts. I do not intend to end this book on such a note of pessimism, but I am not sure I have much choice. Most causes of ignorance can be overcome, if people are willing to learn. Nothing, however, can overcome the toxic confluence of arrogance, narcissism, and cynicism that Americans now wear like a full suit of armor against the efforts of experts and professionals. Traditional solutions no longer work. Education, instead of breaking down barriers to continued learning, is teaching young people that their feelings are more important than anything else. Going to college is, for many students, just one more exercise in personal self-affirmation. The media, mired in competition at every level, now asks consumers what they'd like to know, instead of telling them what's important. The internet is a mixed blessing, a well of information poisoned by the equivalent of intellectual sabotage. Faced with the public's resolute ignorance, experts are defeated. Many of us feel powerless against it, said David Outer, a labor economist at MIT. We feel we can train our students, but our students aren't the public, and we don't know how to school the public. A Yale professor, Dan Kahan, was more pessimistic. Bombarding people with knowledge doesn't help, he said in 2015. It doesn't do anything to explain things to people. But here I am just explaining the facts over and over again. Maybe the joke's on me. One hopeful sign is that experts seem to be rebelling against attacks on their expertise. In decrying the Brexit outcome, for example, James Traub bluntly said that it was time for the defenders of classical Western liberalism to rise up against the ignorant masses. Of course, to do so is to risk the dread accusation of elitism, a charge that has always had more impact in egalitarian America than in more stratified cultures in Europe and elsewhere, as Traub himself recognized, saying, "It is necessary to say that people are deluded and that the task of leadership is to undelude them. Is that elitist? Maybe it is. Maybe we have to become so inclined to celebrate the authenticity of all personal conviction that is now elitist to believe in reason, expertise, and the lessons of history." Nonetheless, professionals across the spectrum of fields in a number of countries seem fed up. Anecdotally, I was struck that after my original article on the death of expertise appeared, I was contacted by scientists, doctors, lawyers, teachers, and many other professionals in America and around the world. They told me not only of their frustration, but of their anger and sadness over ruptured relationships with patients, clients, and students, and even the cooling of close personal friendships, all because they are finally demanding an end to ill-informed lectures about their own area of competence. Medical doctors especially seem to have had enough. To take a humorous recent example, in 2015, Kimmel, yet again, ran a satirical public service announcement in which actual doctors engaged in expletive-filled rants against recalcitrant patients who feared vaccinations. "Remember that time you got polio?" asked one of the physicians. "No, you don't, because your parents got you blank vaccinated." Another said, "I have to use my only day off to talk to you idiots about vaccines," as another chimed in, "because you listened to some moron who read a forwarded email." The Kimmel spot went viral, reported in major media and replayed, as of this writing, more than 8 million times on YouTube alone. The reaction, of course, was swift. Sites like Infowars.com and a host of anti-vaccination bloggers, of course, called the doctors ignorant, tools of a corrupt system, and the other usual insults. But the anti-vaccination wave seems to have crested, for now, in part because professionals and their supporters have decided to use the media and the internet in the same way as the conspiracy theorists. These kinds of efforts in the media will save the lives of some children, but they are not enough to defeat the campaign against established knowledge or to reverse its effects on American democracy. In the end, experts cannot demand that citizens pay attention to the world around them. They cannot insist people eat healthy meals or exercise more. They cannot drag citizens by the neck away from the latest reality television show and make them look at a map instead. They cannot cure narcissism by fiat. Tragically, I suspect that a possible resolution will lie in a disaster as yet unforeseen. It may be a war or an economic collapse. Here, I mean a major war that touches America even more deeply than the faraway conflicts fought by brave volunteers, or a real depression rather than the recession of the early 21st century. It may be in the emergence of an ignorant demagoguery, a process already underway in the United States and Europe, or the rise to power of a technocracy that flatly runs out of patience and thus dispenses with voting as anything other than a formality. The creation of a vibrant intellectual and scientific culture in the West and in the United States required democracy and secular tolerance. Without such virtues, knowledge and progress fall prey to ideological, religious, and populist attacks. Nations that have given in to such temptations have suffered any number of terrible fates, including mass repression, cultural and material poverty, and defeat in war. I still have faith in the American system, and I believe the people of the United States are still capable of shrugging off their self-absorption and isolation and taking up their responsibilities as citizens. They did it in 1941, and again after the trials of Vietnam and Watergate, and yet again after the attacks of 9/11. Each time, however, they slid back into complacency, and each time the hole of ignorance and disaffection they dug for themselves got deeper. At some point, they might no longer see daylight. We can only hope that before this happens, citizens, experts, and policymakers will engage in a hard and so far unwelcome debate about the role of experts and educated elites in American democracy. Recoiling from Donald Trump's march to the GOP nomination, the writer Andrew Sullivan warned in 2016 that elites still matter in a democracy. They matter not because they are democracy's enemy, but because they provide the critical ingredient to save democracy from itself. The political establishment may be battered and demoralized, deferential to the algorithms of the web and to the monosyllables of a gifted demagogue, but this is not the time to give up on America's near unique and stabilizing blend of democracy and elite responsibility. It seems shocking to argue that we need elites in this democratic age, especially with vast inequalities of wealth and elite failures all around us. But we need them precisely to protect this precious democracy from its own destabilizing excesses. Democracy, as Lewis's Screwtape knew, denotes a system of government, not an actual state of equality. Every single vote in a democracy is equal to every other, but every single opinion is not. And the sooner American society reestablishes new ground rules for productive engagement between the educated elite and the society they serve, the better. Experts need to remember always that they are the servants and not the masters of a democratic society and a republican government. If citizens, however, are to be the masters, they must equip themselves not just with education, but with the kind of civic virtue that keeps them involved in the running of their own country. Laypeople cannot do without experts, and they must accept this reality without rancor. Experts, likewise, must accept that their advice, which might seem obvious and right to them, will not always be taken in a democracy that may not value the same things they do. Otherwise, when democracy is understood as an unending demand for unearned respect for unfounded opinions, anything and everything becomes possible, including the end of democracy and republican government itself. That, at least, is my expert opinion on the matter. I could be wrong. This concludes The Death of Expertise by Tom Nichols, narrated by Sean Pratt. Copyright 2017 by Oxford University Press. This unabridged audiobook is published by arrangement with Oxford University Press and was produced in the year 2017 by Tantor Media Incorporated, a division of Recorded Books, which holds the copyright thereto. Please visit Tantor.com for more information on our growing library of unabridged audiobooks and to take advantage of special offers.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.